The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Hello again, and this week I want you to look at yourself very carefully. John Ronson did and decided he was suffering from several forms of mental illness, as he describes in his latest book, The Psychopath Test.
I diagnosed myself with 12 instantly. I had a nightmare disorder. You have recurrent dreams which are either pursued or declared a failure. And yeah, all my dreams are basically somebody just going, "You're a failure!" So I'm running away from them.
And then onward and outward from our recent discussion on the future of the book. J.K. Rowling has given up writing for a bit to launch a website, Pottermore. Is it a big give back to the fans, as the world's richest author has claimed, or a canny piece of marketing? And talking of marketing, how about this for a wheeze? Get readers to subscribe in advance to a new novel. It's the latest idea from a group of innovators, including QI's John Mitchinson. Meanwhile, Faber has taken the iBook into new territory with an app of the wasteland for your iPad.
To coin a phrase, it took me a long time to be alone with him, to hear him.
What are the roots that clutch? What branches grow out of this stony rubbish?
It was much heralded. J.K. Rowling was about to give us more Harry Potter, even though she'd insisted she was not writing another book in the series. This is what she decided she wanted to offer her millions of fans.
13 years after the first Harry Potter book was published, I'm still astonished and delighted by the response the story's met. Even though the 7th book and the 8th film have now been completed, I'm still receiving hundreds of letters every week, and Harry's fans remain as enthusiastic and inventive as ever. So I'd like to take this opportunity to say thank you, because no author could have asked for a more wonderful, diverse and loyal readership. I'm thrilled to say that I am now in a position to give you something unique. An online reading experience unlike any other. It's called Pottermore. It's the same story with a few crucial additions. The most important one is you. Just as the experience of reading requires that the imaginations of the author and reader work together to create the story, so Pottermore will be built, in part, by you, the reader. The digital generation will be able to enjoy a safe...
So here with me in the studio is our children's books editor, Julia Eccleshare. Julia, do you think JK is actually offering her fans something, or is it a canny piece of marketing?
Well, of course, it's both, isn't it, in a sense? Yes, I think she's offering them something, but we are in this extraordinary stage with these big authors where, you know, you could publish their laundry list, and what's slightly frightening is we've always known that, but now you can publish anything. And she is giving them stuff. She's giving them these famous 18,000 words. She is giving them stuff in the sense she's giving them it's a very attractive, interactive experience with the book, and they can go back and kind of study bits and find all the backstories and all of that. But of course, it is also an amazing platform on which to sell the ebooks. And she's found a way of breaking all the rules about selling ebooks and can do it straight off the site.
So she's cutting out Amazon, basically, isn't she?
Yes.
And bookshops.
And bookshops and the publisher. It is a way of kind of grouping everything under the J.K. Rowling site. So the digital audiobooks and the ebooks will all be available from the site. But the experience, I mean, the extraordinary thing about it is, because of the amount of money behind it, is the experience, the site, is free. So a free-to-use site is going to attract a fantastic number of readers around the world. And what they buy off it, we don't know yet. But if that's going to be the only place that they can buy the ebooks, they're going to buy it off there.
Is there any creative content?
There's masses of creative content, but it's old content. Jo hasn't written anything new for this. What she's done is that she's publishing... If you click on Professor McGonagall, for example, you can hear all the backstories about Professor McGonagall, which are part of material that Jo had conceived before. Like everybody else, she's got bits that didn't actually get in the book, so she knows much more about the characters. When you go onto the site, and because it's the whole Hogwarts experience, you get sorted by putting on the sorting hat and answering the questions. If you find yourself, to your great disappointment, not being a Gryffindor, and get sent off to another house, the bonus is you get a lot of material about that house, which we've never heard because we have only ever seen Hogwarts through the Gryffindors. Mm-hmm. So your bonus for not being a Gryffindor is the extra material about Ravenclaws or Slytherins or whatever it is. So there is more material, but I mean, you know, 18,000 words is not an awful lot of words when it comes down to it, not for Potter fans. Is she giving something back? It's something that people who are already very keen on her books are going to find and are going to enjoy a lot. It's not going to change their experience, particularly of the Harry Potter books. It's just a nice piece of additionality.
Okay, well, we'll park that there for 2 seconds while I introduce our other two guests, two of the founder members of Unbound, which is another new venture based on the sort of burgeoning technological opportunities. John Minchinson is the publisher of Unbound, and Tibor Fisher is one of the inaugural writers who's going to be brave enough to open his shed and his head to all comers, or is he? John, first, I just wanted to have your thoughts on Harry Potter.
I think it's pretty exciting. I mean, I think it probably indicates a seismic shift. I mean, there have been writers, Stephen King, who have published directly. But the fact that this is the world's most successful author, essentially bypassing publishing to set up a website that will supply ebooks directly to her readers, I think is a pretty important moment.
I see a little twinkle in your mercantile eye there.
In a way, why shouldn't she? She's created this extraordinary... Now, you might argue that the publishers have also helped it, and I would argue very strongly. I don't think this spells the end for publishing, but I think it's probably a shot across the bows, because authors of this kind of magnitude, with the amount of financial resource that they have, can do this, and I think they will increasingly do this, because why not?
Well, I'm really glad to hear you say that, because I think it's fantastically exciting, and I think it's particularly exciting because it's a children's book, and how children engage with readers is very, very different. Children's Absolutely. Authors are miles ahead on this. Yeah. They're miles ahead on face-to-face interactions with their readers, but they're also miles ahead on the on their web interactions with children as readers. And it seems to me that we have here got something which may, we're in a country which is, we're always being told, has a national crisis about reading, and we've come across something that's actually going to make children want to engage with books, to engage with reading more, and we're all sort of saying, do we like it, and being mean about it. I think that's just ridiculous. And if I'd been a children's author, on Thursday evening I would have been in touch with my publishers and said, I'm binning my website, I want to change it into something that can do 59 more different things. Because I think children have been going to these author websites for ages. The authors have worked pretty hard on them, but their sites are going to have to be completely and radically revamped.
Tibor, what does this mean for you as an adult novelist?
Well, I wish I could do it. The only thing that surprises me is that no one's done it before. I mean, the only downside for writers is that because the revenue won't be going to the publishers, there may be less money for new talent, because the way the big houses work was that they used the successes of their commercial authors to fund the first-time writers and the more exotic projects. So they'll be losing out. And unfortunately, I think it probably does mean that some up-and-coming writers may find it harder to get launched.
Okay.
Although Bloomsbury it is important to point out, Bloomsbury are getting essentially a royalty, from J.K. Rowling.
So the table's been turned.
I know, if the e-books are as successful as I think we think they will be, that is sort of swelling the pot. And I mean, at least on the face of it, Bloomsbury appear to be delighted, as you would be. It's a huge, the biggest brand in world publishing, and you've helped build, and you're getting a percentage of the.
Okay, well, let's now move on to your project, John and Tibor, which is Unbound. Can you explain to us, in simple terms, what exactly this is? It was launched at the Hay Festival.
Yes, it's in some ways it's a very old idea. It goes back to subscription in advance. An author has an idea, pitches the idea on the website, and we then gather pledges of support, financial pledges of support. If we gather enough of those to enable the author to go ahead and write the book, we have a target, which we agree with the author and the author's agent. If the target is met, the book goes ahead. If the target isn't met, the people who've put their money in hitherto get a full refund. But what it's doing is I think, trying to re-engineer the relationship between writers and readers. It's making that a very direct relationship. And instead of saying we're dependent on the good taste of a small group of people who work in publishing, it's saying, well, why don't we get writers to pitch the ideas they really want to write, and readers then to judge whether they want to read them.
It's sort, in a way, it's sort of X Factor for books, but it also allows for the possibility of greater choice, because even established and successful writers often have certain projects that they can't get off the ground because they want to do something different, and their publishers are a bit sceptical about
it. Is this true of you, Tibor?
No, not for me, but I have many friends some very well-established writers who've had certain books that they've had problems with. So it's a chance for greater choice, for greater biodiversity, and also for readers. I mean, I'd love to sponsor a book by one of my favourite writers, because you're not just buying a book, you're also enabling a book to happen.
Now, I say I want to come and sponsor Tibor. How much do I have to give him?
We have a range. This is one of the things, is we think publishers in general, we're pretty, as an industry, we're pretty bad at taking money off people who are passionate about the writers that they want to follow. Your best chance, really, is you can go and watch them read at a festival, or you can pay for a discounted hardback via Amazon or your local bookshop. What we do is we start at a low level. A £10 pledge will get you access to the ebook once the book's written, right through to £250 plus, where you might be getting lunch with the author or spending a day out doing something that the author particularly wants to do, possibly going to the theatre. And in between that, there's signed and dedicated copies. It's sort of a sliding scale. Each book project will have a set of rewards which we agree individually with each author.
You've got a pounds POA, make it happen. that's your super deluxe version.
That's the sexual favours.
have you had any POAs yet?
Actually, we've had some interesting inquiries, and I tell you why. It's something that we're working on, is the possibility where people would look at a project and say, I really want this book to happen. But I'd like to put in I'd like to either buy fund the whole thing, or fund it, and we can then begin to have possible discussions even on an investment level. Say, well, if you're really that serious. The really important thing is that, as Tibor said before, is that you're offering people a way into the process of the writing of the book, a connection with the writer, which is entirely up to the writer. It's not a question of asking the readers to write books for you, but certainly sharing chapters of books when you're happy with them.
What do you think about this, Tibor? Writing is quite a solitary thing, isn't it? You're going to invite people in to see, you know, to watch the words going down on the page.
Well, I think Seneca wrote that everyone's shed should be open for inspection. I'm cheating slightly in that what I'm putting up is something already written. It's two short stories, which I've already finished, which are going to be a little bijou edition. But I think a lot of writers... It's in some ways what the relationship with the editor used to be, that, you know, it's nice to have someone who's paying attention to what you're doing and keeping an eye on you, because writing is a very solitary thing. So it's nice, to have the idea that some people are checking up on what you're doing. I probably also encourage some writers to actually finish what they're doing, because it's very easy just to watch daytime television or develop an interest in, you know, French medieval history or something to keep you away from the typewriter.
One of the nice things about this is that we have more money to spend on things that I know from my sort of 25 years in the trade, that readers, it really matters to readers. Readers really care about paper and binding and the quality of the books. So it's a paradoxical thing. Although we're absolutely pushing the digital end of things, we're also offering people the chance to get beautifully bound, traditionally printed and typeset books as well, because I think that's what readers are like. I think most of us probably would like to have both editions of a book. You know, the revolution that's happening isn't, I think, about moving, you know, from printed texts to digital texts. I mean, that's just moving from one medium to another. The real revolution is the possibility it offers to change the relationship between the reader and the writer, and that's what J.K. Rowling's doing. Mm. It fundamentally changes. It offers readers what a lot of readers want, which is they don't want to live in the living room of the writer that they follow, but they want some contact. They want to feel that they're part of a club of a group of people. That's how word of mouth happens. People feel part of something, and I suppose what we're trying to do is to some degree to sort of turbocharge that word of mouth process.
Mm-hmm. It's a sort of democratisation between the writer and the reader,
yes.
Which I think certainly in children's books has happened quite continuously, and I think the way children's authors in the last 5 years have been, you know, trojanly going around the schools is part of that. You know, they are actually making writing not be a mystique, not be something up on a pedestal, but something that you work with your readers and you engage.
So Tibor, how's the watering going in your little patch?
When I checked this morning, and I do admit I check quite regularly, it's about 20%.
And what happens? Will you be very, very sad if you don't get the 100% you need, or might you drop your price?
Well, of course, like every writer, I want unlimited wealth and power and millions of fans. I think, you know, we'll get there. It's on target to hit.
Do you have a date, a deadline for?
There is a deadline, which we'll probably extend. I mean, one of the lovely things about this is we are walking to some degree in the dark. There is a very successful site in America called Kickstarter, which we've modelled ourselves on, and they have a rule of thumb that if you get beyond 25% for funding for any project, it almost always goes on to get. It's a sort of a tipping point, which Tibor is trembling dangerously close to at the moment.
Like to see Tibor trembling.
Can I just put in one sort of point of caution? I mean, it sounds sort of like patronage. And the way you were talking about it at the beginning, about people sort of being able to buy access to the author of different kinds, and it could be a trip to the theatre, or it could be just seeing inside the writer's room. It's a bit worrying in this world where also we've got, you know, in the brave new big society, you can buy a school, or you can buy, you know, half an education authority, or you can buy whatever. Can you now buy a writer? I'm just worrying about that.
I think you could always buy a writer, frankly. You know,
they're cheap.
If the price is right, you know.
I can see exactly where you're coming from. I don't think you can, in the end, buy a writer. I think what we're trying to find is a more creative way to make the kind of books that at the moment are becoming uneconomic because publishers are increasingly looking for, you know, the larger and larger returns in order to fund the bigger and bigger discount that the retailers are asking for and the promotional spend that they're having to put. So what that means is that about 65% of the business in the UK, at least, are authors who sell between 1,000 and 50,000 copies, and they are generally referred to as mid-list writers. And those are the authors at the moment who are struggling to get advances.
Very finally, tell us who are the other writers apart from Tibor who we could be investing our hard gained earnings on.
At the present moment, we have Terry Jones of Monty Python fame, who is writing a rather wonderful sort of dark Roald Dahl-y sequence of stories called Evil Machines.
Now, he's done children's books, of course, so he's used to being very interactive.
The interesting thing about Terry is one of the reasons, apart from the fact that he likes the idea, is that this set of stories fell between two stools. The old where do we put it in the shop problem, because they are, they're perfectly, the first two stories which are already up on the site, they're perfectly readable by children and are funny, very funny. But it gets darker and more complex as we haven't got to the end of it yet, but you can see that it's starting to become rather more than simply it's becoming more of a sort of a satire, rather dark satire, as I say, slightly Roald Dahl-y in its tone. There's Amy Jenkins, who is the writer of This Life.
She hasn't written anything for ages, has
she? It's a very interesting story. She wrote This Life, was a huge kind of cult in the 90s. Then she got a huge advance for two books, and she wrote what essentially was Chick Lit. Mm. And they sold quite well, but she got horrendous kind of critical mauling, because I suppose people thought that This Life was rather sophisticated and the books weren't. And so she has come back to writing. It's taken a long time to get over that. You know, it is tough. You put that stuff out there and people don't like it. And she's now writing something that I think will be much closer to what I suppose This Life fans would have liked. It's a sequence of relationships, starting with her relationship with her mother. It's probably fictionalised memoir is the way I'd describe it, but very strong. As I say, there's a bit already up on the site. You can also have, we're about to put up a historical novel by Rupert Isaacson, who was number one bestseller last year with a book called The Horse Boy, a non-fiction book about taking his autistic son across Mongolia. The Horse Boy is about a Elizabethan horse whisperer, a real man called William Banks, who was one of the most famous street performers in Elizabethan London. It's a sort of, it's a romp, an Elizabethan romp, a historical novel.
Right, I'm going to stop you there, except for just to add that one of the other writers is Gavin Pretapini, who's doing a cloud project, and he's doing it through Touch Books. And Touch Books, of course, are responsible for The Wasteland, which we're reviewing next.
April is the cruelest month. Breeding lilacs out of the dead land, mixing memory and desire, stirring dull roots with spring rain. Winter kept us warm, covering earth in forgetful snow, feeding a little life with dried tubers. Summer surprised us, coming over the Starnbergersee with a shower of rain. We stopped in the colonnade and went on in sunlight into the Hofgarten and drank coffee and talked for an hour. Bin gar keine Huschenstamm, außer Teuen, echt Deutsch!
April is the cruelest month. Reading, lilacs, out of the dead land, mixing memory and desire, stirring dull roots with spring rain.
The really interesting thing, as far as I'm concerned, is that the app has made it possible to bring alive things that we didn't know that we had in the archive. We discovered that there was a hitherto unknown recording of Eliot reading The Wasteland. It's much earlier than the 1946 recording, it's 1933.
Winter kept us warm, covering earth in forgetful snow, feeding a little life with dried tuber.
When we were children, staying at the Archduke's, my cousin's, he took me out on a sled, and I was frightened. He said, Marie, Marie, hold on tight, and down we went. In the mountains, there you feel free. I read much of the night and go south in the winter.
This poem, which seemed famously, if not notoriously, to be the most original work of its era, and possibly of the century in which it appeared, is a work of collaboration. The Wasteland drafts include not just Powerman revisions and corrections and markings, but also Vivian's own. What do you get married for if you don't want children?
I don't think books need saving in the sense that the iPad or any other device can and will save them. I think I don't like the save mentality for the publishing industry. What I do think is the books business and writers and publishers could and should use technology to their best advantage, because other people will if we won't.
A game of chess. The chair she sat in, like a burnished throne, glowed on the marble, where the glass held up by standards wrought with fruited vines, from which a golden cupidon peeped out. Another hid his eyes behind his wing, doubled the flames of seven-branched candelabra, reflecting light upon the table as the glitter of her jewels rose to meet it.
I knew that Eliot was the modern poet par excellence. I had overheard that at school. So I asked, an aunt of mine promised me to, she would get me books, and I asked for T.S. Eliot's collected poems. And I got them, and they simply scared me off. I had no way of getting into them. And then schooled myself as an undergraduate into it with the secondary literature and so on. To coin a phrase, it took me a long time to be alone with him, to hear him.
What are the roots that clutch? What branches grow out of this stony rubbish? Son of man, you cannot say or guess, for you know only a heap of broken images where the sun beats, and the dead tree gives no shelter, the cricket no relief, and the dry stone no sound of water. Only there is shadow under this red rock. Come in under the shadow of this red rock, and I will show you something different from either your shadow at morning striding behind you, or your shadow at evening rising to meet you. I will show you fear in a handful of dust.
This is the latest publication of T.S. Eliot's much-loved and discussed poem, The Wasteland. Touch Press and Faber have spent 2 years on an application for the iPad exploring the multimedia possibilities of the great poem in every available way, even down to specially commissioned typography, reproduction of the original manuscripts, including Ezra Pound's amendment, and some amazing performances, as you've heard. Our poetry specialist, Sarah Crown, has been looking at the app overnight. Sarah, what do you think of it?
I loved it. I thought it was absolutely brilliant. I'd have loved to have had something like this at university, because it just brings the poem to life, I think, for you. I particularly liked the critical perspectives that were given by Heaney and Craig Raine. And again, those are things that feel to me to be very clearly aimed at students of the poem. But then also, if you're just a reader, if you're just coming to the poem for pleasure, there's so much here that just amplifies the pleasure that you can get from it. And beautiful readings from various people, Viggo Mortensen, Fiona Shaw's performance of it, which is perhaps not quite to my taste.
She was Winnie, but... wasn't she? She's Winnie from Happy Day. She does Elliot according to Beckett.
Yes, via.
Nothing
yeah.
wrong with that. It's different. What I found absolutely amazing about it is that you can, as you're reading the poem itself, if you click on any one line, you can then yeah. click on any one performance. So you can have one Fiona Shaw line, one Viggo Mortensen line, yeah. one Ted Hughes line.
Well, that's one of the important things to say about it, I think, is that it's not, the idea is a great one, and probably it's an idea that several people have had. But what's so brilliant about this is the application of it. It's so beautifully done. It's elegant. You know, I mean, it's for an iPad, so to say that it's at your fingertips is slightly redundant, probably, but it really is. You just kind of walk your way around it, and it's, every room leads onto another room. It's just, it's brilliant, I think. It's fantastic.
What about the fact that it's just for iPad? I have to say I had a real struggle with it, trying to download it. It took me sort of 2 hours into the wee small hours of the morning.
Well, this is the thing, and we don't know yet whether this is going to be a beautiful cul-de-sac that will, you know, I mean, the obvious corollary is then Betamax, Sony Betamax in the early 1980s, which was the video player that did absolutely everything brilliantly, and there was stuff that was designed specifically for it, and all of the real aficionados went for that sort of technology. But then, of course, it was eclipsed entirely by VHS, who had everything quickly and cheaply, and even though the quality wasn't as good, that was what everybody went with, and we don't know yet whether that will be the case for iPads, whether it will end up being a slightly redundant technology.
And but I have to say that we've actually been having quite a problem getting people to... we want somebody to review it yeah. for us. And they all say, but I don't have an iPad, don't they? And these are university people, poets, yeah. even one distinguished theatre critic.
Indeed. I should remain nameless. But it's possible that will be the case. We just don't know yet. I think the best thing that could happen really for Apple is for people like Faber and Touch Press to develop things that are so sort of beautiful, things like this Wasteland app. Again, you know, we see here with poetry, there are so many things that you can bring into the mix if you can suddenly add in video and audio and all of these things.
And typography. I was really interested in yeah. that they'd commissioned a font that works yeah. on the iPad. And it's a beautiful font, very
it
classical,
is. It's
elegant
gorgeous,
font.
Yeah, the icing on the cake, really. With fiction, with books, with novels... I haven't seen one that's worked yet, so we'll have to wait and see.
Watch this space. And now for something completely different. John Ronson. How could he be like anyone else? He's focused his attention this time on one of society's most feared outsiders, the psychopath. He told Lindsay Irving about how this fresh fascination started.
I'd read this manual, the DSM, the American Psychiatric Association's Manual of Mental Disorders, and a lot of
pathologies,
mental disorders,
yeah.
And I diagnosed myself with 12 instantly. I had a nightmare disorder. You have recurrent dreams which are either pursued or declared a failure. And yeah, all my dreams are basically somebody just going, "You're a failure!" So I'm running away from them. So this opened up a whole lot of questions.
Yes.
A, am I crazier than I thought I was?
Mm-hmm.
B, is it not a good idea to read the DSM if you're not a trained professional?
Mm-hmm.
C, is the psychiatric profession, does it have a sort of fetish for diagnosing normal behaviour as disorders?
Mm.
And I really wanted to try and answer that question. And that's why I ended up having lunch with the Scientologists, because I thought it would be interesting to meet fundamentalist critics of psychiatry.
Right, it's an interesting perspective on it, because the Scientologists have absolutely no truck with psychiatry at all.
They're anti-psychiatrists. They basically believe that anxiety disorders don't exist and it's just a normal response to an anxiety-inducing world. But it's not just Scientologists who believe it. Lots of clever people believe that too. I think it's an abhorrent thought that people who say they have mental disorders don't. However, I also thought, well, I bet they've got a massive resource of times when psychiatry's got it palpably wrong, and it would be interesting to hook into their resource. So I had lunch with them, and I said, prove to me that psychiatry is nonsense. Prove it to me. And I said, OK, we can introduce you to Tony. And Tony, when he was 17, beat a guy up in Reading to get out of his 5 to 7 year prison sentence for GBH. He faked madness. But he faked it too well by channeling David Cronenberg and David Lynch movies, telling the prison psychiatrist that, just like in David Cronenberg's Crash, he liked to crash cars into walls for sexual pleasure and so on. So faked madness far too adeptly and got sent straight to Broadmoor. the minute he got there, realised he'd made a spectacular mistake and has subsequently been trying to convince everybody that he's sane and no one will believe him. And he's been trapped in Broadmoor for 12 years.
So you went along rather cautious and met somebody who seemed really quite strikingly sane in the context of Broadmoor.
Yeah, he was unlike the other patients who were mainly overweight, sweatpants, shuffling. And then some of them were dressed in kind of a eccentric, colourful clothes. Tony came in dressed in a pinstripe suit and was like walking towards me like, you know, like someone at The Apprentice with his arm outstretched.
Yeah, so about to sell you a mobile phone or something.
My first thought is this is the outfit of the man who really wants to convince the world that he's very sane. And he sat down and tried to convince me of his sanity. And sure enough, he seemed like utterly sane. There was nothing that seemed insane about him. He said it's impossible to convince people you're sane when they think that you're crazy. So, for instance, he would buy New Scientist just so he could chat to psychiatrists about normal things like medical breakthroughs. And he said quite recently he'd read an article in New Scientist about how the US Army was training bumblebees to sniff out explosives. So he mentioned it over lunch to a psychiatrist. And then when he read his medical notes, they'd written, "Believes bees can sniff out explosives." Also, he didn't want to hang out with his neighbours, who included the Stockwell Strangler and various people like that. So he stayed in his room a lot. And they took that as a sign of madness because he was grandiose and withdrawn and reclusive. And so he pointed out that only in Broadmoor would not wanting to hang out with serial killers be seen as a sign of madness.
And as you explore it, it becomes clear that psychopathy is quite a distinct variety of madness.
Yeah. After I left Tony, I spoke to his clinician, Anthony Maiden, who said, we accept that he did fake madness to get out of a prison sentence because his delusions were very florid, kind of cliched, and the minute he got to Broadmoor, they all vanished. So we accept that his story is true. However, we've assessed him and we've decided that he's a psychopath. And in fact, everything that seems sane about him, he didn't say this, but this is what he was saying. It was evidence that he was a psychopath. The pinstripe suit speaks to grandiose sense of self-worth and glibness, superficial charm. Not wanting to associate with his fellow patients speaks to lack of empathy, grandiosity. Faking your brain going wrong to get out of a prison sentence speaks to pathological lying.
These sort of characteristics are linked to a typology formed by a man called Bob Hare, who you also run into, who, if not mad himself, is certainly a bit of a character.
Yeah, well, he invented the psychopath checklist. He decided in the 60s, when other psychologists were trying to treat psychopaths and cure them, his philosophy was, no, they can't be cured. It's, you know, the only time psychopaths stop being a malevolent whirlwind is when they get too old and lazy to get up off the sofa. He was very hard line. He would almost speak of them as if they were a different species. And so he developed this checklist of 20 points, nuances of psychopathic behaviour, which is now taught all over the world and is incredibly influential.
And it's a very sort of seductive idea, isn't it? The idea that it's like something out of science fiction, is that we're surrounded by people who give every appearance of being perfectly sane, and yet they are creatures of quite otherworldly menace.
Yeah, like Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
It is kind of like something out of science fiction, isn't it?
Yeah, and in fact, David Icke, in my first book, Them, he spoke about how the world was being ruled by blood-drinking, paedophile lizards who've adopted human form. And this is basically the same thing, except this has total mainstream acceptance.
Some of the psychopath population are in prison, but a lot of them are at large. And there's a disproportionate, it's a commonly held belief that there's a disproportionately large number of them who are sort of heads of industry.
Yeah. And I have come out the other side of this story, and I do actually believe that there's truth to that. The statistics that they cite, the psychologists cite, is 1% of the general public is a psychopath and 4% of people at the top of the pyramid of psychopaths.
Well, this is, I mean, instanced most floridly in your book by Al Dunlap, who was an asset stripper.
I meet him in Florida, and his house was filled with a vast collection of sculptures of predatory animals. and there's lots and lots of stories about him firing people with a quip, somebody would say something like, oh, you'll never guess, I've just bought a new sports car. And he'd say, well, you may have a sports car, but I tell you what, you don't have a job. Or he'd go to a factory in Mobile, Alabama, and ask somebody how long he'd worked there. And the guy said, 30 years. And he looked confused and said, why would anybody want to work somewhere for 30 years? And then he closed the plant down and fired everyone. And then there were lots of stories from his personal life, like he threatened his first wife with a knife. And even though he was always giving interviews about his wise and supportive parents, he didn't turn up to either of their funerals.
Some people have actually sort of go on to sort of float the idea that the reason capitalism is so beastly and merciless is not because it's something in the nature of capitalism, it's just because it attracts so many psychopaths.
Yeah, and rewards psychopaths. And in fact, the non-psychopaths, a bit like in a relationship, you know, quite often it's very empathetic, nice women who end up going out with high-scoring psychopaths. And it's because, you know, we mistakenly think they're kind of cool. You know, they're charismatic, they're sure of themselves, they're charming. You know, we make them our bosses, and then the structure of the business becomes psychopathic. And I think you see that a lot. You see it in the banking crisis, subprime market especially. At journalism an awful lot of the time.
Well, you speak to somebody who worked on a reality TV show who says that the best selection criteria
is to ask what medication they're on.
Yes.
And if they're on something that symbolises a frightening mental illness, she kind of won't have them on. But if they're on something like Prozac that implies they're angry and fragile, that's perfect.
You can get tears and shouting, but no knives or anything.
I mean, just look at the sort of Song of the Deluded in the final of The X Factor every year.
Yes,
and that's
true.
One of a vast number of examples.
John Ronson there. His book, The Psychopath Test, is published by Picador. Sarah's still with me here in the studio, and she's stuck around to tell us what else we should be looking out for this week.
Yes, in Saturday Review on Saturday, we have various views of Mervyn Peake, whose Gormenghast trilogy has just been beautifully republished, as seen by Michael Moorcock, China Mieville, Hilary Sperling and A.L. Kennedy. And also a profile of the author, Cynthia Ozick.
Well, you're very keen on
Cynthia, aren't you? I am very keen on Cynthia Ozick, so I'm looking forward to reading Emma Brock's profile of her this weekend. The Observer's new review on Sunday has an exclusive interview with Rupert Grint, who plays Ron Weasley in the new Harry Potter film, and the old ones as well.
And we've got the 10 best literary picnics. Sarah, tell me what your best literary picnic is.
Well, the literary picnic that you have to mention probably is the one on Box Hill and Jane Austen's Emma. But probably my absolute favourite, my literary picnic, if you will, is the picnic in Grandmother Lucy Goes for a Picnic by Joyce Wood, which is the most beautiful picture book. There's a series of Grandmother Lucy picture books. They're all out of print now, so please will somebody, anyone who's listening, bring them back.
And mine, I have to say, is another children's book. It's Water Rat's Picnic from Alison Utley's Little Grey Rabbit books, which I was totally obsessed with at the age of about six. And what's interesting about that is I think it just goes to show that the books you read when you're very young are the ones that remain as sense memories.
Absolutely.
And of course, there's something in that for all publishers of e-books to bear in mind, isn't there? But anyway, that's all for this week's podcast. My thanks to Sarah, Julia Eccleshare, John Mitchinson, Tibor Fisher, Lindsay Irvin and our producer, Tim Mabey. I'm Claire Armistead. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.